evening, everybody. Let's start with our motivation. Just think of all the vast numbers of sentient beings all throughout the universe in various realms, each one having their own individual experience. Some in the human realm, some in the God realm, some in the hell realms. So many sentient beings everywhere. Some who are happy, many who are miserable. And yet, all of them, inside their own hearts, what they just want is to be happy and to avoid misery. But because they don't know what the cause of happiness is and what the cause of suffering is, though they want happiness, it seems as though they're running away from it and creating the cause for misery. And although they don't want misery, it seems like they're running towards it, creating so many causes. And so somehow, for a very short period of time, we have this human body and mind and some awareness of what this situation is for sentient beings, ourselves included. And this ability to understand the situation and look at what its causes are, see if they can be eradicated, and see what the resulting state of liberation is. Because we have this space in this very short time of the human life, we have a very precious opportunity. And because all these other sentient beings have been kind to us, past, present, and future, we need to use our opportunity without squandering it and do something that will benefit both them and ourselves. And so if we practice the Dharma, transforming our own minds with the intention of attaining Supreme Enlightenment, then that fits the bill of doing something that benefits others as well as oneself and takes advantage of the preciousness in this small little time period we have as human beings. And so let's cultivate that intention right now. Make it very strong and firm in our own minds. Think about what others are going through while you're just walking through your day, going from place to place, doing this and that. Do you ever kind of open your mind and think, wow, what are other sentient beings experiencing at this very moment while I'm eating lunch or tripping out because somebody said something I didn't like? Yeah. It's quite sobering, you know, to think about that. And it brings us back to our fortune and our responsibility towards others. Okay. So there were some questions after last week's teaching. First of all, just to make very clear, when I was talking about the permanent part, this independent self, that one is an acquired grasping in that we gained it, we got it from wrong philosophies and due to some kind of wrong way of thinking, wrong kind of logic or reasoning. So it's something that is completely made up by the mind. You know, this kind of either a permanent, partless, independent creator that's external, or a permanent, partless, independent self that is me. It's something that's completely the creation, you know, of our own mind due to wrong ways of thinking, wrong kinds of logic. So it's something that's fabricated. It's not innate. Okay, we may have sometimes feel, oh, I feel permanent. Okay, but that's our grasping of permanence. Whereas having a permanent, partless, independent soul or self is something different. You know, it's this notion, like I said, of, you know, some kind of external creator or soul that's quite independent. Okay, so then the first question was from somebody online who said, how are you reborn repeatedly without a soul? In other words, what continues throughout lives? Now, a prasangika would answer this, how are you born repeatedly with a soul? Okay? The idea being, if you think, okay, what is a soul? Yeah, a soul is something that's permanent. It doesn't change. Okay, it's partless, so it's one unified monolithic thing. You know, it can't change, can't be more than one thing. And it's independent of causes and conditions, which means that other things can happen, but nothing would affect it. Okay. So if you had a soul that was like that, could such a thing go from one life to the next and carry karma? No. You know, because just the fact of creating karma means change, doesn't it? Yeah. And if something is the same in one life and the same in the next life, and nothing has changed whatsoever, then how could that continue or carry karma or have any effect at all? Yeah. If there was something that was independent of causes and conditions, then karma would be created, but it couldn't affect such a soul. Okay? So if you really look at what having a soul would entail, then you'd see that such a thing can't really carry karma, because carrying karma, you know, involves changing. And creating karma involves change. And experiencing the result of karma involves change. It means being susceptible to the influence of other causes and conditions. Okay? So, if, you know, we can see where this kind of question would come from, because it seems somehow sometimes so secure to have a permanent soul, a permanent something that is always me, because then when death comes, oh, okay, there's something that's always me that's never going to change, that won't go out of existence when death comes. So holding on to the idea of a soul prevents the a nihilistic fear of death, thinking that death means everything ceases altogether. Yeah, so you prevent that by saying, oh no, there's something permanent that's unaffected that continues on and goes to heaven or hell or whatever happens to it. But if you really think deeply about the properties that are being attributed to such a soul or Atman or whatever, you know, could something like that really do what you're thinking it's going to do? Could something like that actually exist? Okay. So then somebody's going to say, well, what carries the karma? What goes from life to life? And so here is where I think the idea of a river is quite useful. Yeah, because a river is a continuity, and yet can we find something that is the river? Yeah, we have Spokane River now. Okay, well, it's not just now, but I mean, when I used to live in other places, sometimes we didn't have a river to refer to. But, you know, Spokane, there's a Spokane River. And we talk about it like it's something and we all know what it is. But when we ask what exactly do the words Spokane River refer to, yeah, is it upstream? Is it downstream? Is it the sides of the river? Is it the water? Is it the bottom? Is it the silt? What exactly are we referring to when we say Spokane River? Yeah, when we search for something that is it, we can't find it. But when we don't search, then we can talk about the river and the river functions. So in the same way, we can talk about a continuity of consciousness. Yeah. But we can't find something that is that. Yeah. Or we can say that there's a mere I that's labeled in dependence upon that consciousness. And that mere I goes from life to life. But again, that mere I is something that's merely labeled. It isn't the consciousness. And even if we say, you know, the consciousness goes from life to life, again, which consciousness? We can't isolate any single moment of it that's fixed, that exists in its own right. Okay? So we say that the mere I, that's, you know, the I that is exists by being merely labeled in dependence upon, you know, the aggregates, or when we're talking about going from lifetime to lifetime, you know, the I that's merely labeled in dependence upon the mental consciousness. It's something that exists by being merely labeled, but we can't find exactly what it is. And yet it still functions. So then you say, well, wait a minute, how can it function if we can't identify what it is? Yeah. Well, if we could identify what it is and draw a line around it and say, this is the mental consciousness that is me, then that mental consciousness would have to be permanent, wouldn't it? Because as soon as we say, this is me, it's different from the previous moment. And to have something that is a stable me that, you know, is always there, that means it couldn't change whatsoever. Okay? So we keep coming back to this thing that if something existed independent of other factors, it couldn't change. It would be fixed and static and permanent in the sense of not changing moment by moment. Okay? Yeah. So, you know, there isn't something that we can, you know, like I said, draw a line around and say this goes from life to life. Yeah. Now, you're going to say, well, what about, you know, like the Dalai Lama, isn't he the recognized incarnation of, you know, the 13th Dalai Lama, because he's the 14th, so we're the 13 before him, and isn't he exactly the same person? Okay. Well, in terms of talking about a general I that happens to be labeled on whatsoever aggregates happen to be there, the 14th Dalai Lama exists in that continuum of, you know, the general I. But is the 14th Dalai Lama the same person as the 13th Dalai Lama? No. No. Okay, the body isn't the same. The mind isn't the same. You know, wait a minute, it's the same mind. If it's the same mind, then it still must be the mind of the 13th Dalai Lama thinking the same thoughts as the 13th Dalai Lama thought. In which case, His Holiness couldn't be talking to us now because he would still be saying the same sentence over and over and over again because he was permanent from a previous life. Okay? So, although there exist continuities, you know, there's nothing fixed that continues there. Very often, you know, us ignorant beings, when we talk about, you know, recognizing the incarnations of great masters, we just project all of our grasping at true existence right on there. You know, like, oh, it's the same person. Mean the same person? Are you, you know, oh, did he remember me? You know, like, he knew me 10 years ago. Does he remember me now? He's the same person. Does he remember me? Are you the same person you were 10 years ago? Yeah? So do you see, we very naturally, you know, we ask these questions using conventional language, but sometimes we'll freeze one component or the other. Like, I change, but he's got to have exactly the same mind. Huh? Okay. Okay. So that was one question. So, you know, there's just this conventional continuity, you know, that creates karma, experiences the result of karma, something that's, you know, arising and ceasing in each moment. But we can't isolate something that for sure is me. Okay, then the other question was, you explained the gross misconception of I, the permanent, partless, and independent self, and mentioned the self-sufficient, substantially existent self, and the inherently existent self. So those are sometimes like three levels of objects to be negated. You did mention, in refuting the permanent, partless, and dependent self, that you contemplate theological consequences that would result if there were such a self? Okay. Does one need to work on these three levels? You know, permanent, partless, independent, self-sufficient, substantially existent, and then inherent existent? To work on these three levels separately, or does working to refute and realize the absence of an inherently existent self also eliminate the first two grosser levels of self? Okay. Yes, if you negate and refute the existence of an inherently existent self, that automatically refutes the existence of a permanent, partless, independent self and a self-sufficient, substantially existent self. The reasons we talk about these three different kind of layers of objects of negation is because it's easier to recognize the very gross ones, and it's harder to recognize the inherently existent one. Okay? So the whole idea of a soul, you know, that's easier for us to think about, you know, and identify with and, you know, and negate. And then when we get into the self-sufficient, substantially existent one, that one's a little bit more subtle, okay? And then the inherently existent self is even more subtle. So in learning them, it's helpful to learn the grosser ones and learn how to refute them, and that helps us get to the subtle one. But once you knock out the subtle one, you've already gotten rid of the gross ones. Okay? So we'll be going into some of these, you know, unpacking what these other terms mean. And, you know, I've been looking ahead a little bit in the book, and I'm not real happy with the translation, either that or I'm not happy with my understanding of it. It could be a little bit of both. But what I think I'm going to do is, in some cases, maybe not read everything, but talk about the point that they're bringing up. You know, because sometimes the way it's included here, it's, you know, what the pronoun it refers to makes the sentence completely kind of nutty. Yeah. Or other things like that. Okay. So I'll read a little bit now, because this upcoming part here is, you know, it's understandable. Okay, so ignorance, or a lack of basic awareness, is diametrically opposed to awareness. Okay? It is not merely other than awareness, nor is it the mere negation of awareness. It is the opposing factor that directly counteracts awareness. This awareness itself should not be understood as just any sort of awareness, but as the discriminating intelligence, discriminating wisdom, that cognizes the meaning of selflessness. That being the case, ignorance is that which exaggerates phenomena, conceiving of them as being self-existent. Okay, this involves two kinds of, well, let's go that far. Okay? So, these are the sentences that make sense. Okay, so it's talking about what ignorance is, okay? So, when it talks about awareness, awareness is the wisdom that understands realities, the term sherab in Tibetan, or prajna in Sanskrit, pana in Pali. And so, this awareness understands reality the way it is. Ignorance isn't just the opposite of it. It isn't just a not knowing, but it's a mind that grasps precisely the opposite of what wisdom grasps. Okay. Now, the lower schools, when they, you know, when a Sangha, for example, talks about ignorance in his text, the Compendium of Knowledge, their ignorance is just like a darkness, okay? It's a not knowing. Yeah? And in the Pali tradition, it's described that way too. It's a not knowing. In the Prasangika viewpoint, it's not just not knowing. It's actively grasping the opposite of what actually exists. Actually grasping things to exist in the exact opposite way from how they do exist. So whereas things arise dependently and are empty of true existence, ignorance grasps them as truly existent. It's not just that ignorance is a fog, but it actively grasps them in the wrong way. Okay? So then we have to see, you know, well, how do things exist, and how does ignorance grasp at the opposite way? But sometimes there's a little bit of a translation thing here to look at. The word grasp in Tibetan is zin. Yeah? The same word zin can also be translated as apprehend, you know, as in just apprehending something. So that word doesn't always mean, you know, grasping a truly existent. It can mean just apprehending something. It's often, even when it's used in the context of grasping a true existence, some translators call it conceiving, the conception of true existence. Okay? And it was used that way in here. Okay? Conceiving true existence. Conceiving inherent existence. I feel that translation gives us slightly the wrong impression. It is a conceptual mind. Okay, in that way, that translation is accurate. It's not a directly perceiving mind. It's not directly. Ignorance doesn't directly perceive things as inherently existent, because there's no inherently existent things you can directly perceive. So it is conceptual in that it's a thought consciousness, and it's, you know, perceiving things through a conceptual appearance. However, when we think of concept, our American, or Western connotation of concept is a very gross kind of concept, isn't it? We think of it as I'm sitting here thinking in words. Yeah? When you think of thought or concept, don't you think of it as, you're deliberately sitting here talking in words in your mind. And then you say, well, that's not great. That doesn't make sense. Because I'm not sitting here looking at people thinking, oh, they're truly existent. So how can you say that, I have the conception of true existence that's operating? Because I don't even know what it is. How can I sit and think that people are that? But actually, when we're talking about concept here, we're not talking about that gross kind of thinking concept that we use. It's a very, very subtle kind of concept. And so that's why I think I prefer the word grasping, because it doesn't confuse us in thinking that it's just a thought, like we usually think of thought. And also because the word grasp, grasp is intense, isn't it? Grasp has some feeling behind it. I am grasping it as inherently existent. I am holding on tight. It is like this. Whereas you say, I'm conceiving it as true existent. Well, I'm conceiving it like, I think of the Wizard of Oz. I conceive the Wizard of Oz. We don't get the same force or power of it. Yeah? Whereas it's a mind that really grasps, that holds on to things. It exists like this. I am sure this is how it exists. It's not just, philosophically pondering. But here we're talking about the innate grasping. The acquired grasping is philosophical pondering. But the innate grasping grows with us from one life to the next. And it just comes, in babies and animals, you don't have to have language and sit there and be thinking in your head. It's just, hold, grasping as hard as you can. Okay? So don't get confused about the terminology here. So now it continues. This involves two kinds of misconceptions of self, that of persons and that of phenomena. Okay? So the objects of these two are the objects of the mode of exaggeration projected onto persons and phenomena. That is the self of persons and phenomena. Okay, so what it's talking about is, generally speaking, when we use the word phenomena, it's synonymous with object of knowledge, existent object. It means anything, a phenomena means anything that exists. That's the general usage of the word phenomena. When we talk about the self of persons and the self of phenomena, okay, there, phenomena refers to everything that isn't a person. Okay? And specifically to a person's aggregates. Yeah? But also in the more expanded way, to anything that isn't a person. So in that context, in self of persons, self of phenomena, phenomena doesn't include persons. Okay? So we have a self of persons and a self of phenomena. We have a self grasping of persons and a self grasping of phenomena. And we have a selflessness of persons and a selflessness of phenomena. Now you're going to say, wait a minute, selflessness of phenomena? Isn't the self the person? How can you talk about the selflessness of phenomena? Well, the word self can mean different things in different contexts. Okay? So sometimes when we talk about the self, the self means person. Myself, yourself, how do we experience ourself? In that context, self refers to a person, to I. But self can also refer to the object of negation, inherent existence. in the case of prasangikas, or in the case of the lower schools, you know, a self-sufficient, substantially existent, or, you know, something that is not the same nature as the object, as the consciousness perceiving it. You know, according to the different philosophical traditions, they assert different kinds of selves. So their self means an object that has been gated, an object that school says doesn't exist. So then the selflessness would be the absence of that. Okay? That in truth, you know, that self-sufficient substantially existed didn't exist, or that thing being a different nature than the perceiving consciousness, that doesn't exist, or, you know, something being independent of all other factors, that doesn't exist. Okay? So just be aware that self can mean different things at different times.
Is it synonymous? I don't know if I've heard the term, but it sounds familiar, like self-existence of self, or self-existence phenomenon.
Okay. Yeah, so sometimes we hear the term self-existence. Yeah, so their self is also referring to the negative, to the object of negation. Yeah. And then different schools define self-existence differently according to what they think that object of negation is.
It would be appropriate to use the words in that way.
Yeah.
Self-existence of self, self-existence of
phenomena. Well, we would usually say self-existence of person, self-existence of phenomena. Okay? Okay, now, let's see where it goes here. Okay, so in addition, the most vital factor in determining selflessness, okay, is to ascertain the extent of the object of negation so that neither too little nor too much is negated. Okay, if the object of negation is too extensive, existence and true existence will be mingled together as one. And since we accept that the mental projection, true existence, is what is to be negated, here it just gets into one of these long sentences. Why don't I just explain to you what it means? Because this sentence is like, you know, a paragraph. Okay, so what it's saying is that it's very important to identify what the object of negation is. Okay? And that's, you know, one of the foremost things we try and do, especially when we're meditating, so that we know very clearly what it is. Yeah, we're trying to see if it exists or not, if things exist that way or not. If we don't negate enough, okay, so if this is the object of negation, if we don't go close enough to it, we don't negate enough, then some of the grasping at true existence is still going to be there. If we go overboard and negate too much, then we're going to have a nihilistic view. So here's where we get the two extremes of absolutism, which is sometimes translated as permanence or eternalism, and then the other extreme of nihilism, also translated as annihilation. So if you don't negate enough, it's absolutist, because there's still remnants of an absolute independent self that you're hanging on to. If you negate too much, then you fall into nihilism and you can't establish conventional existence. Okay. Now, what's very interesting is both the absolutists and the nihilists have the same misconception. It's just they resolve it into opposite ways. But their misconception is the same in that they think existence and inherent existence are exactly the same thing. And they think non-existence, you know, total non-existence, and emptiness or the lack of inherent existence are exactly the same thing. Okay? So both of them have this problem. Yeah, confusing conventional existence and inherent existence, thinking that they mean the same thing, and confusing total non-existence with the emptiness of inherent existence. Okay? So, the way they resolve that is that if the somebody comes along and says, okay, oh my goodness, you're negating inherent existence, that means you're negating all existence. Whoa, that is going too far, buddy. You can't do that. Things inherently exist because they do exist. You can't say that things are empty. Because if you say they're empty, they're non-existent, and that defies my experience. So if they're, you know, if they're not non-existent, then they've got to be inherently existent. Okay, so that's how the absolutist resolves it. Okay, then the nihilist says, well, hey, yeah, you know, existence and non-existent, existence and inherent existence are the same thing. And if you negate inherent existence, you're negating all existence whatsoever. So nothing exists, you know, it's all just a dream, so, you know, kind of hang loose. It doesn't exist, and there's no karma anyway, so do what you want. Okay? So do you see how they have the same misconception? But the absolutist says, wait a minute, you can't say things are totally non-existent. That's too much. That's wrong. So they've got to inherit. If they exist, they inherently exist. And the nihilist says, yeah, in existence, inherent existence, same thing. You negated inherent existence. There's nothing there. So just forget it all. Okay? So right now, we're at the absolutist end. Okay? Because we're all grasping at true existence. The nihilist actually is grasping at true existence too, except they don't realize it. They're just resolving it in the other way by saying, well, no, it's total non-existence. Okay? Nihilism is more dangerous than absolutism because even if you're an absolutist, yeah, and I'm talking about philosophically or, you know, even just our innate grasping, you still can have a respect for cause and effect and karma and its effects. But if you're a nihilist, then you lose respect for karma and its effects because you say it's all a dream. Yeah? My eyes, what they're telling me, there's nobody out there. You know, there's no real sentient being. I can do what I want. Nobody's going to experience any suffering. There's no real me. There's no real karma. They go to this kind of extreme like that. And that is very, very dangerous. Because with that kind of philosophical view, then you just do whatever and you don't take care of your actions because you think that they don't have any effect. Okay? So that's why, you know, our teachers are constantly, when they teach us emptiness, they immediately establish conventional reality. Of course, we can't discern conventional reality, so we go right back to grasping at true existence. But the idea is, you know, eventually when we get to negating true existence, at least then we'll have some imprint in our mind to think, oh, but things don't totally non-exist. Okay? So this falling to nihilism, that actually only happens when you're trying to develop an inferential understanding of emptiness. When you have a true understanding, when you've arrived at the correct view, you know, when we're chanting the three principal aspects of the path, you know, and it says your analysis of the view is complete, when you have that complete view, then you can see how things are empty and how they can still conventionally exist. You don't fall to nihilism if your analysis is complete. It's only when it's not complete, you know, that you go overboard in there. You know, and like I said, that can be quite dangerous. They always say if you're going to fall to an extreme, go to the absolutist. But, you know, we're absolutists right now, grasping at true existence, and that keeps us in samsara. So we don't really want to stay at this extreme either. Okay? Because that's just a mess. Yeah? You with me so far? Okay. So this whole thing about avoiding the two extremes, this is the meaning of the middle way. Okay, when Nagarjuna talks about the middle way, this is the meaning of the middle way. You know, philosophically between these two positions. There is another meaning of the middle way that you encounter, which is when we're talking about the path of practice, and the Buddha talked about the middle way being not total asceticism and not sensual indulgence. Okay? Because at the time of the Buddha, there were all sorts of people, you know, who said, oh, my senses, you know, they're kind of, I see something and I want it and I'm craving and I'm clinging and, you know, I'm just controlled by my attachment. And this is, I keep getting reborn out of, you know, attachment and desire and I've got to stop this. And so then they think, well, how to stop it? You do the ascetic thing, okay? So there's this tradition also in Western culture, you know? They used to wear shirts made of hair and self-flagellation and things like that. The idea being that if you torture the body, then you get rid of the attachment to the body and the attachment to sensual pleasures. And the Buddha showed by his own life that that doesn't result in realizations, that you can torture your body all you want, and it doesn't get rid of the attachment. Okay? It's only wisdom that gets rid of the attachment. So he didn't teach this thing. You know, at the time of the Buddha, you know, there were these wild, matted hair ascetics who never bathed, and people who stood on one foot, and people who jumped in the fire and stood on their heads. And even in India now, you can go, especially in Rishikesh, there's a lot of, you know, people doing different kinds of ascetic practices. And the Buddha himself tried that, you know, for the 6 years before he crossed the Harijana River to go under the Bodhi tree. He was you know, eating one grain of rice a day and being an ascetic. And when he realized that didn't work and started eating again, his other five friends said, oh, you softy, you know, you're eating, you flaked out on us. But then they wound up being his first five disciples when he became a Buddha. Okay, so that middle way between sensory indulgence and asceticism, that's one meaning. But here we're not talking about that meaning. We're talking about the middle way being the philosophical meaning. And when it's called the middle way, it's not that here's absolutism and here's nihilism and you average them out. Okay? It's not the middle like that, you know? Like there, absolutism and nihilism are on a continuum and you just go halfway between the two. Because they're both wrong views. So going halfway between two wrong views doesn't get you to a right view. Okay, you still have two halves of wrong views. So the middle way actually is something completely outside of this thing. Because it's not, the middle way view is not based on that premise that if it exists, it inherently exists. And if it doesn't exist, you know, if it's empty of inherent existence, it's totally non-existent. Okay, so the middle way is not part of that continuum on that line there. Okay? So when we talk about the different philosophical views, the Prasangikas are outside of those two extremes. Yeah. But all the other traditions are somewhere along there between them. Okay, so in the ancient India, you had this materialist school, the Tribhakas, you know, and they said that, you know, there are some things that just happen totally without causes. You know, not everything without causes. They weren't, you know, completely stupid. But, you know, like the roundness of peas and the sharpness of thorns and the color of a peacock's feathers and, you know, those kinds of things. They would say it happened without causes. Yeah. And they would kind of take a more substantialist view and a more hedonistic view. So they fell on the nihilistic extreme. Then you had other people who, you know, believed in an Atman and a soul. You had the whole Brahminical class, you know, with the creator god, Ishvara, you know, who you worshipped and all of that kind of thing. And then we don't have those exact same schools nowadays, but we still find views that are quite similar. Yeah, because you could take a completely scientific reductionist view and say, if I can't see it with my senses, it doesn't exist. Yeah, and if I can't measure it with machines, then we can't prove it. And the mind doesn't exist, future lives don't exist, karma doesn't exist, there's only atoms and molecules, and everything that exists should be measurable in terms of scientific instruments. So that's falling to a nihilistic extreme. That's negating way too much. Yeah. And then you have kind of the, you know, Hollywood, excuse me, you know, sense pleasure deluxe. It's not limited to Hollywood, it's everywhere. That sense pleasure deluxe thing, you know, of grasping at stuff as well. And then you have views of, you know, of an independent absolute creator. You have views of a permanent self. There's all sorts of views in various, you know, mainstream religions and also New Age things. Yeah, sometimes the New Age view, it reminds me of the Samkhyas, which was an ancient Indian school. They had this idea that there was this universal substance, you know, and that everything appeared out of this universal substance. So if you translate that into New Age views, it's, you know, well, there's one cosmic substance. Yeah? And everything just appears out of this mysterious cosmic substance and dissolves back into it. You know, on a rough level, you know, it's similar. So, you know, these kinds of views exist, I think, in all societies and all historical times, just in their own particular variety. Okay? Okay, so the problem with negating too much and going into nihilism is that then you can't establish conventional existence. Yeah, because you've gone to the other extreme. So then when you try and establish the existence of samsara and nirvana and the path to enlightenment, and you try and advocate for a path to enlightenment that creates these causes and abandons those causes, if you're fallen into nihilism, you can't do that because everything is somehow totally non-existent. Yeah, because you've negated inherent existence. So you can't establish conventional reality. You can't establish the path. Yeah. And then similarly, if you're in the absolutist camp, it becomes very difficult to establish conventional reality too. You do in your own way. Yeah. But then as soon as somebody kind of asks you a question and scratches the surface of the view, then it becomes very difficult to defend that view. Like we were just saying now about if you think that there's a, you know, a permanent, partless, independent soul, yeah, and somebody just starts asking you questions, well, how can that exist, and da-da-da-da-da, and again, you can't establish, you know, what your belief system is. Well, the nihilists negate both, and because they've confused existence and inherent existence. See, they think when you negate inherent existence. You're negating all of existence. So they're not seeing that there's inherent existence, and then there's general existence, and general existence is conventional existence. Okay? So they get those two things completely mixed up. They think they conflate them and think they're the same thing. Okay? Yeah. So then, yeah, then trying to establish, you know, why you have to abandon some actions and practice other actions, they can't do it. Yeah? Because, well, everything's non-existent, you know? Okay? Okay. So here it's just saying that when people can't establish valid existence, then they get very confused in how to present the basis, path, and result. You know, we always hear these terms, basis, path, and result. Basis is conventional existence. Path is what you practice, and result is what you're aiming for. Okay, so, you know, the two truths are the basis, ultimate truth, conventional truth. The path is, you know, like your bodhisattva path, generating the wisdom, realizing emptiness, and also doing the method aspect of the path, those practices out of compassion. And then the results we're aiming for are the two Buddha bodies, the truth body and the form body of the Buddha. So we've been through this before. Do you remember? Mm-hmm. Kind of these different pairs and how they go together. Okay. Okay. So if the object of negation is too narrow, which means you haven't negated enough, although the principles of the four seals of the Buddhist doctrine are unanimously acknowledged by all Buddhist traditions as being literally what was spoken, when we set out to identify the self which does not exist, that is referred to by the seal, all phenomena have no self, then the rest of the English here is difficult. Okay, then what happens if you have that confusion is that you take the selflessness of the four seals to be the mere selflessness of the person. And then you think that that selflessness of the person is just the emptiness of being a self-sufficient, substantially existent person. Okay, so let's backtrack here because you're probably saying, what in the world are the four seals? Okay, so the four seals are four principles or beliefs that establish a school as being Buddhist. So the first one is that all conditioned things are impermanent. Okay. Second, all tainted things are in the nature of suffering. Third, all phenomena are lack of self or are selfless. And fourth, nirvana is peace. So His Holiness, when He teaches, He very often begins a talk talking about these four. Okay? So these four have a general meaning that apply to all the Buddhist schools, and then the Prasangika are going to have their own individual one. Okay? So what this is saying is if you don't negate enough, then when you're at the third seal, saying all phenomena are selfless, what you do is you interpret that to mean that the person is selfless. You don't interpret it to mean actually all phenomena. So you're just talking about a selflessness of persons, and the self that you're negating on the basis of the person is a self-sufficient, substantially existent self. Okay, which is, from the Prasangika viewpoint, is considered a gross self of persons. So when the Prasangikas look at this third of the fourth seals, okay, all phenomena are selfless, they say, oh, it means not just persons, it means persons and aggregates and all phenomena lack a self. And the kind of self they lack isn't just a self-sufficient, substantial, existent one. It's an inherently existent one. Okay? So the lower schools, all the schools except the Prasangika, when they talk about the selflessness of persons, they're negating not only a permanent, partless, independent self, because all Buddhists negate those, but they're negating a self-sufficient, substantially existent self. Okay? And for the self of phenomena, the two lower schools, the Vibhasakas and the Sautantrikas, they don't assert a self of phenomena, except to say that nothing is an object of possession, nothing is possessed by that kind of self.
They assert a self of phenomena or a selflessness of phenomena?
They assert a selfless. They don't assert, the Vibhasakas and Sautantrikas don't talk about a selflessness of phenomena. Oh, well, they don't talk about a self of phenomena either. Because if they talked about a self of phenomena, they would negate it and talked about the selflessness phenomena.
You also seem to imply that the Vibhasakas negate
sufficient, substantially existent person. Yeah, they do. Yeah, all the Buddhist schools negate self-sufficient, substantially existent person.
I thought all those Buddhist schools negated permanent, infinite.
Yeah, they negate that. And they negate self-sufficient, substantially existent person. But, and we'll get into this, the Prasangikas say that there's actually there's a coarse, self-sufficient, substantially existent person, and there's a subtle one. And the Prasangikas say the lower schools negate just the coarse one. They don't even negate the subtle one.
So they see the different schools as holding a different idea of what that is.
Yeah. The Prasangikas see that, the schools have, they differ on what they think self is in terms of the object of negation. Mm-hmm. So what they think selflessness is different. What they think self-grasping ignorance is different. Mm-hmm. As soon as you change the meaning of the object of negation, then self, self-grasping, selflessness, the meaning of ignorance, all these things change. And what you have to eliminate to attain different stages of the path, that all changes as soon as you change the object of negation. Okay? So from the viewpoint of the Prasangikas, the lower schools, they're getting somewhere, but, you're not going to be able to attain even the path of seeing or even the path of preparation with those views, because they aren't the deepest view. You aren't negating enough. Yeah. So they would say that all the Buddhist schools fall on the absolutist end.
Would it also be correct to say that the view of the different schools of the self-sufficient, substantially existent self differs?
So is it accurate to say the view of the meaning of self-sufficient, substantially existent self, that differs? Between the lower schools and the Prasangika, yes, mm-hmm. It differs. Yeah. Between the lower schools themselves, no, they mean the same thing. Yeah, what they're negating is the same thing. Okay. But what you have then is that the Vibhasakas and Sautantrikas, they negate a self of persons. They don't really negate a self of phenomena. The Chittamantras and the Madhyamakas, they negate both a self on both persons and phenomena. Okay. Within the Madhyamaka, you have the Svatantrikas and the Prasangikas. And the Svatantrikas go more towards the lower schools on this, in that what they say a self of persons is a self-sufficient, substantially existent person. So to realize the selflessness of persons, you have to negate that kind of self. Okay. And then they say the self of phenomena is true existence, and you have to negate true existence on both self, on both persons and phenomena, and they put that as the selflessness of phenomena. Whereas the Prasangika, you know, so for the Svatantrika, it's not just the object, you know, the self or phenomena, it's the level of what you're grasping and what you're negating that determines selflessness of person and selflessness of phenomena. Okay? Because for the Svatantrikas, if you negate true existence on the person, okay, that is a selflessness of phenomena. Because they say the selflessness of person is just the non-existence of the self-sufficient, substantially existent person. Okay, you with me?
No.
Okay.
I think I'll help you later.
Oh yeah, we're at 8:01. Okay. Next week. Next week.
We'll go over one more time.
Okay. So, if you have self of persons and self of phenomena, okay, the Svatantrikas say that the self of person is self-sufficient, substantially existent person. Okay? The self-grasping of persons is grasping at a self-sufficient, substantially existent person. And the selflessness of persons is the absence of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person. Don't go into subtle gross right yet. Just stick with this. Okay. Then the Svatantrikas, when they look at the self of person, it means, or the self of phenomena, it means true existence, whether it's the true existence of a person or a true existence of a bell or a body or a mind. Okay? So for them, when you differentiate between the two selves of person and phenomena, it's also a degree of what the object of negation is. Okay? Because the Svatantrikas will say the self of phenomena is true existence, whether it's the true existence of a person or true existence of other things. Whereas for the Prasangika, when they say selfless as a person, selfless as a phenomena, there's no difference in the object of negation between the two, because in both cases the object of negation is inherent existence. Okay? And so this gets into the whole thing, because the Svatantrikas say that an arhat, for example, you know, if you negate self-sufficient, substantially existent person, that's how you can become an arhat. You don't need the selflessness phenomena. So it gets into all these different assertions of the different schools. Okay? But we won't go into all of that right now.
Good.
Are the Svatantrikas' definition of true existence inherent existence, or is it a different definition?
Yeah. Now, how Svatantrikas and Prasangikas define inherent existence differs. Okay. So that's why sometimes I'll use the word inherent existence synonymously with, the word true existence synonymously with inherent existence when I'm talking from a Prasangika viewpoint, because the Prasangikas say they're the same. Okay. But the Svatantrikas say that there's some difference between them. Okay.
Neva spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all our hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray.
May the lives of the venerable spiritual masters be stable and their divine actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losung's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the 3 worlds always increase. Guru Ratna Mandalakam Niratayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Taro, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May the born of love decline but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful tempting gets of timorousy, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially Yatra Vastiya be in the West flourish.